together to fight for what we love.
And a significant amount of privilege and power over other groups.
You're listening to
Consider the Alternative.
Consider the Alternative.
Consider the Alternative.
Consider the Alternative.
A CITR podcast.
Hello, my name is Guilherme Rosales.
And my name is Josh Taffel.
Today we're going to be talking about a contentious issue, rent control, and essentially the Vancouver housing issue of affordable housing. Today we're going to look at the history of rent control, and specifically we're going to hone in on vacancy control as a mechanism or a policy option that Vancouver should be considering today. But it's important to ground ourselves in a historical context to understand all the nuances of this issue. And before we get to that, we're going to start with some definitions. So, Josh, what is rent control?
Right. Thank you, Guilherme. So, rent control is basically policy that how it works in Vancouver is that they put a limit on percent increase rent can go up each year. So, we have had policies in place since the 60s that limit rent increases per tenant to once a year. Rent control has been instituted to limit the amount they can increase it per year.
Right. And then vacancy control.
Right. So, vacancy control is a little bit different. So rental control, as it is right now, it has an increase per the tenant that is there.
Yeah, it's percentages. It can be in the form of taxes. It's trying to regulate the rental market and maybe a little more broadly the housing market.
Yeah, so vacancy control would essentially tie those increases to the unit rather than to the contract with
the person.
The person.
Right, because as it stands, if I'm a landlord and I don't like my tenants, what I can do if they're, you know, I'm charging them $800 a month, but I realize I could be charging them $1,500 a month based on current market prices, then what I could do is I could claim at the end of their lease that I'm going to renovate, and then that after the renovation, they're going to have to leave because either I'm bringing in my family or my friends, or alternatively, I'm just demolishing my entire place and building something new. So these are tactics landlords have used and still try to use. We've seen it before. Not all landlords, of course, but some, in order to price gouge and make as much as they can on their investment.
Right. So it's something that current Vancouver councillor Gene Swanson has referred to as renovicting.
Yes, that's right. Renovicting.
Evicting for the purpose of renovations or renovating for the purpose of eviction.
Yeah, and vacancy control would stop that because it would say, well, you can go ahead and renovate, but you can't charge an exorbitant amount to the next tenant. It has to be pretty much the same. But there's stipulations that we'll get into because this policy isn't so simple. It can be modified, as we'll see. So now that we kind of got an idea of what rent control is, we know that Vancouver is facing an affordability crisis in terms of housing, and it's really important to make that distinction because you will hear that Vancouver is facing a housing crisis, which is true, but specifically it's an affordability crisis. And we will get to that point a little later when we talk about the supply and demand of actual units in Vancouver. So let's start with the history. You mentioned the 1960s, I think it was the 1970s that rent control was really instituted in BC. Specifically Vancouver.
Yeah. So I was referring to in the 60s, they brought in the policy where you could only increase the rent once per year.
Okay.
There was no limit on what that increase could be
until,
as you're saying, in the 70s.
Right. BC's seen rent control since the 1970s. But let's go a little further back. And rent control in Canada has actually been around much longer. It's been around since the World Wars. This was done, obviously, in interim war efforts and post-war efforts to provide people stability. Coming out of the war was rocky economic times, though the major deregulation moment occurred when the federal government transferred rent control over to provinces soon after World War II. That's when we saw a major kind of shift in regulation, and a lot of provinces didn't really do anything with that power. They just left the market the way it is, with the exception, of course, Quebec and Newfoundland. So fast forward to the 1970s in BC. There was a lot of conflict, a lot of tumultuous moments. There was the creation of the Vancouver Tenants Council. So what what's interesting, I think, is in the 70s, we really are starting to see tenants organizing and pushing for
mobilizing
For rent control. But I guess I want to ask, what circumstances, you know, led to this? What were the issues that would eventually lead to vacancy control? Well, as we know, in the 70s, vacancy rate was low. Vacancy rate was around 1% in the 70s, and at the end of the 70s, it was 0.2%. So it dropped throughout the 70s. Housing prices were increasing. There were instances of landlords trying to increase prices by sometimes 28, 30% without notice. So Vancouver Tenant Council was established in 1968. The same conditions were fueling renters to organize back then as they were now. Back then, there was no notice given for rent increases. So the first push of the Vancouver Tenant Council in the late 60s was for this notice to go through. So they protested and got the support of Harry Rankin, a city councillor at the time, in 1968. Eventually, a settlement was reached with landlords in the struggle that culminated in giving tenants 3 months' notice before rental increases. And there could only be one increase per year. So that was like the tail end of the 60s, what you mentioned there.
Well, yeah, 60, what was it, 68 or 69?
Yeah. So. and then come the 1970s.
Yes. So, 1970s come. We have a period of high inflation. NDP government comes in and they decide to introduce rent control.
And what kind of led to this, because they came into power in 1973, was in 1971, there was a 5 month strike led by tenants withholding rent because they had been hit with a 10% rent increase. The final settlement saw in the one building in Vancouver, one apartment building, 25 tenants evicted of the 264 that withheld rent, but no rent increase was permitted in the interim 5 month period.
People were boycotting them.
They were
not
just boycotting
their rents.
They kind of won this battle, but a lot of people also left, probably as part of a boycott to this. Then comes the NDP government. Their platform was that they were going to give tenants bargaining rights, but they reneged on this. An instance in 1973 of more conflict was the Block Brothers, developers, instituted a 25% increase for their buildings. Tenants organized. A city council passed a resolution that rent increase should be limited to current inflation, which at the time was 9.2%. So the economic conditions of the 70s was somewhat different, right? There was less regulation around inflation and probably fiscal monetary policy.
Yeah, it was definitely not as well understood today as today, rather.
Definitely. A lot of policy was enacted without evidence-based decision-making. A lot of it was kind of done more intuitively. So then the NDP passed the Landlord and Tenant Act with some regressive features. So one of those was the
73, 74. Right.
And what they created a rentalsman who was essentially a person who would see rent increase percentages, you know, based on case by case, and you could dispute it to them, but generally he was viewed by tenants as on the side of the landlords.
Right. They were not happy with
it. Exactly. But one progressive feature was that landlords needed to show just cause for evictions.
Yes. And I think in that article that you're referring to,
the
that was
lender,
kind of, that was the big kind of success of that.
And when you think about it, that's a huge success in the 70s for people who are fighting for rent control and beginning to get some, because before this, you could be evicted for anything.
Right.
People could jack up rent without anything. And it's kind of crazy to think, if you're living in, you know, the mid to late 60s, that I could be evicted for any reason and my rent could go up 30, 50% for any reason at any time without notice. So I think it makes sense given this historical context of an economy running rampant in terms of inflation and a low vacancy rate that people are getting angry and they're going to organize and fight for some sense of rights.
Absolutely.
So obviously this culminated in another conflict where landlords pressured the rentalsmen to increase rent to 28%. Tenants organized, took their case to city council, and for 1975, the rental increases were limited to 10.6%.
Right.
This led to the establishment of the Rent Review Commission, who authored a report that was largely ignored by city council. In this time, new construction was, interestingly enough, exempt from rent control. So this was the beginning of decontrol, where the NDP, you know, was at the end of their power in the late 70s, 1976, 77, and the Social Credit Party was gaining power.
Yeah.
So now we're going to kind of go in a bit more here to talk about the various acts that occurred. So in 74, we saw the NDP pass the Interim Act. It was an interim act between the old Landlord and Tenants Act to the new, which is still our current Residential Tenancy Act. In this kind of act period between the early 70s and the late 70s, in 1973, we saw an amendment to the former act, and this amendment led to vacancy control. So it said, you know, percentage increases were not tied from person to person, but they were tied to the unit. So Vancouver has had vacancy control before, and it's really important to note this. From 1973 to 83, it was instituted. But around 77, 78, when the new Residential Tenancy Act came in, we saw some deregulation and decontrol features coming into play. One of the biggest features was that new construction, as I've mentioned, was exempt from rent control. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, the next big real kicker to you know, make sure vacancy control would go by the wayside was this idea that vacancy control would only apply to 1 to 2 bedroom apartments. Anything beyond that, if it was a multi-bedroom house, would be outside of rent control. So in the beginning of the 70s, we're seeing the NDP, the Social Credit Party, supporting these rent control measures. And then at the end of the 70s and 80s, we're seeing decontrol.
And it's interesting because the Social Credit Party was elected in 76?
76, towards the end of 76.
Right, yeah. Right. So, and it was actually in their platform, there in the article, there was a picture of an ad they took out in the local newspaper that said, "We will not take away rent control."
And then, of course, they get into power and they help provide legislation that leads to decontrol.
Leads to decontrol, exactly.
Massive deregulation.
So, over the course of about 5 or 6 years, it slowly kind of went away.
It was interesting to see, I think, that the Social Credit Party's narrative was no rent control, you know, neoclassical theories of economics. Deregulate is better for the rental market. And then they switch, and then they switch back in terms of positions. Whereas the NDP was very consistent, but they faced pressure and caved a lot of the time to make sure businessmen and you know, business people and investors were, you know, not feeling excluded. But I don't know, maybe you can give us some idea of what these economist theories are. Like what's really driving the opposition side to rent control?
Right. So the main sort of opposition is, I think the best argument they have is that it leads to less development.
Yeah.
So it basically inhibits supply. It says neoclassical economics, supply and demand, the free market meet at the equilibrium.
Yeah.
You know, that's the best sort of price, according to economists. So they would argue that you're actually limiting the supply of housing and you're actually making it harder for people to find housing.
Right.
So that would lead to a very low vacancy rate, according to that side of the argument.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting also to mention that in one of the papers we read from the 1990s, Lazarin did her thesis on the rent control and deregulation and rent control in the 70s, the time period we're talking about, was that there was this constant rhetoric on the side of opponents to really solidify that no competent economist would advocate for rent control.
Mm.
They kept saying, without real tangible proof, that rent control would be, you know, the death knell for developers. It would be terrible for people in the long run because you wouldn't be able to get a house.
Mm-hmm.
Rent would increase. But if we deregulated, then the market would take care of itself.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and
yeah.
There is some evidence that when you institute vacancy control and rent control, that does lead to less development.
Yes.
There was a study of 4 cities in California.
Yes.
Vacancy control they were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But it does lead, it makes it more expensive for landlords and for developers. So it makes sense that they would invest less into development.
Yeah. So let's get into this now. Now that we've got a better historical understanding of the 70s being a tumultuous time, conditions leading up to vacancy control, and really the conditions that led out of it was, you know, the swing back in the political spectrum,
right,
the push that, you know, the opponents won. They got into power and they set the stage for incremental deregulation into the 80s that led to complete deregulation. And as the findings of Lazarin points to, that in the 80s, what was already, you know, a deteriorating market just got intensified and worse after deregulation. And her ultimate conclusion was that it was really hard to discern whether rent control actually affected anything in terms of the market. She said there's no clear link between rent control affecting economic conditions. What did affect economic conditions was level of GDP, inflation, interest rates, and of course, flows of migrants, inland migrants coming from, you know, different parts of BC and leaving Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in this kind of effort to further understand positions, we're going to now just quickly listen to the Vancouver Tenants Union and one of their representatives and what they think about vacancy control. So I'm here with Will Gladman, a representative from the Vancouver Tenants Union. Will, how are you today?
I'm doing okay, thank you. Just starting to feel the hay fever, unfortunately.
Oh, it's that time of year. So I was curious, what is the Vancouver Tenants Union views on vacancy control as a policy option for Vancouver?
So we're very firmly behind vacancy control as a policy option for Vancouver, as one that protects the people who are most at risk in this housing crisis that we're experiencing at the moment. The housing crisis is bad for everyone, whether you're an owner or a renter and at whatever income level. But we're finding that the most vulnerable people at the moment are low and fixed income renters. And these renters are facing really twin crises of affordability and displacement. And vacancy control we see as an option to combat both of those problems.
Yeah, do you think from the developer's side of this story, they claim that vacancy control would be the death knell to development. But recently I was looking at an article that was claiming essentially that the supply side of housing that's needed in Vancouver is actually a myth. We have more than enough supply to house people. The problem is affordability. So in terms of what developers are saying, what are your thoughts on kind of their position and why they're against vacancy control?
Yeah, I mean, the thing we have to remember about landlords and developers is that fundamentally they're profit-seeking enterprises, and their primary motive is to make a profit for themselves. So it's not very surprising that they're coming out against measures to increase affordability for tenants. I think supply is an important part of the equation, but what we should be talking about is affordable supply, and that's not what landlords are and developers are promising. They want to keep building more market rate supply, which, as we're seeing increasingly, really isn't meeting the needs for low-income and fixed-income tenants.
Okay, thank you, Will. That was very educational. Okay, so you heard it. They are supportive of it because obviously their position is to protect tenants' rights and build upon them. Now, let's kind of talk about this idea. So this study was done in California by Professor Heskin and Garrett, and they studied four cities that had vacancy control. Do you want to talk a little more about that?
Yeah, so I can bring up the findings here. So essentially they did a study of these four cities in California. Fortunately, I can't remember which cities they were.
I think one of them was Berkeley.
Berkeley, okay.
Which was noticeable. And then there's a few other kind of smaller cities.
Right. So they compared them to other areas, I think, in California. And they found that vacancy control led to lower rents.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense. Longer tenure by tenants also makes sense. But also fewer new rental units created in these areas than in the comparison areas. And there was also, interestingly, a conversion of a portion of the housing stock from rent to ownership.
So ownership increased in these cities.
Yes, yeah. That's correct.
I think what's really interesting is, once again, that study found that there was no clear link between rent control and housing market fluctuations. So once again, the rhetoric of the opponents is just that. It's just words. They're not presenting real, hard, empirical evidence. But something that's interesting, I think, in this study and a few of the other studies we've looked at is that more empirical analysis is needed to really determine what's going on, because I think this study mentioned that the data locally and contextually can actually support almost any side, which shows to the complexity of the issue. Something else that was interesting that was noted, I think, about these authors was that they said, yet in regulation, in rent control, what they tended to notice was that it took the edge off prices of homes, but it also secured that the housing market would not bottom out or crash. So it's almost like all this evidence is suggesting that in regulation, we're seeing a more managed kind of market where, you know, you don't get the big highs, but you also don't get the big lows. You get something in between that's a little more equitable, but still potentially, I think, if done correctly and with some economic incentives, still profitable for people. But obviously, I think it's a very complex issue.
It is complex. And yeah, I mean, like you said, there's numbers, data you could use for both sides. So
yeah. Other interesting points in the study was that homes did not fall into a state of disrepair as the opponents suggested. You know,
right.
Rent control means homes will fall into a state of disrepair. Landlords less frequently renovated. So I think this pushed kind of the incentive of landlords to really only renovate when they needed to, as opposed to when they wanted to.
That's interesting.
I know. The prices of homes were not affected, the land value in the long run. But obviously, as I mentioned, it took the edge off home prices.
Right.
So I think it's reasonable to think if vacancy control as a policy option does go through or is considered seriously in Vancouver, those are considerations to have, to maybe think a little more long-term as opposed to short-term. So I think now it would be nice to kind of maybe get into the opponent's kind of side of things. So we got some information from the Urban Developer Institute and along with the Fraser Institute. Josh, would you like to kind of give us more of the, I guess, underlying thoughts or even perspective of the economist mm-hmm. and kind of the opposition, because they really want to rely on the economic kind of theories and analysis right. for this issue.
Sure. So there's economic arguments on both sides, I think.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the opponents, like I've mentioned, the main argument is that it decreases rental construction. So the argument is essentially that looking at vacancy control, they're not going to be able to charge the prices that they want to charge. So therefore, it's not going to be profitable for them, to
right.
developers, to develop new homes, new apartments. And that's the kind of argument that we've seen from the Urban Development Institute.
Yep.
In their survey, they mentioned this number, 12,000 new units
are under threat.
Yeah. Right. And so that's,
I was going to say, they also point to the vacancy rate, right? That's right. the issue. Because the vacancy rate is, they're saying like less, 1% or less.
Right. That's right. So that's the other argument, is that there's people who want to live in these places, but since they're not being built, because mm-hmm. they're, theory, not profitable for the developers, then supply is not meeting demand.
So I want to pause here, because I think this is like their main argument. Supply
right.
is not meeting demand.
Right.
But I think in this research, I was asking myself, but what are they, like, what kind of supply? Mm-hmm. Like luxury supply? Affordable supply?
Because
mm-hmm. Currently the vacancy rate is less than 1% of Vancouver. But this doesn't really tell us, are all the homes being lived in? Or is this merely calculation done by who, like full ownership of places? Because it's clear that I think that most of the places in Vancouver are completely bought up.
Mm.
But like the bigger question is how many of them are just sitting empty or in
right.
some pseudo fashion of empty. I think one statistic from the Vancouver Sun or Vancouver Courier mentioned that 1 in 10 homes sit empty. So mm-hmm. if that's the case, then our actual, you know, like the real versus the nominal rate of vacancy would be 10%. The real vacancy rate would be 10%. But the nominal, the, you know, just what we're going by in terms of land ownership or home ownership, it's 1%. So I think that's really important to note.
That is interesting to note.
Yeah. I mean, we kind of have an understanding of where we've been, where we're coming from and going, and now we're here in this situation where we have multiple taxes instituted, such as the foreign buyers tax.
Right.
That's 15%.
Yeah.
Such as the speculation tax, which varies depending on registering and whether you're a Canadian mm-hmm. citizen. Empty homes tax, which is 1% of your property.
Right. And these are interesting because I think mm-hmm. these are trying to get at that problem that you just mentioned.
Yeah.
Of how, you know, the real vacancy rate is quite high.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people do think it's because people use the Vancouver housing market basically as speculation.
Mm-hmm. So then it's interesting that, you know, the opponents are saying there's not enough supply to meet the demand, when actually we look at the Vancouver fact sheet for housing. There's
right.
about 66,000 dwellings that are mm-hmm. currently in oversupply. So technically in Vancouver, we're actually at a surplus for housing units.
Right.
And one professor, Dr. John Rose, who's creating a working paper on debunking the myth of the housing supply in Vancouver, suggests that this is a myth. We have more than enough supply to last us for the next 5 years or so.
Right.
We don't have to keep building exponentially. So this leads me to think that, you know, if we created vacancy control and developers say, oh, well, you know, we're going to have to move to another city, I think that's fine because we have enough houses. The issue is affordability.
The issue is well,
mm-hmm.
let's break this apart a little bit.
Yeah.
Because it seems like if we have a whole bunch of vacant homes, then maybe there's a problem with the incentive to actually rent out that home.
Yeah. You don't think the problem is that the price is too high?
I mean, if you think about it, if the price is too high, they're charging too much for rent, and therefore mm-hmm. nobody is coming to rent the house, the logical step would be to lower the rent.
Yeah.
So that they have somebody to rent it out.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering, I mean, that seems like a complicated issue. And maybe there's barriers to renting that.
Yeah. And I think this is where the, you know, foreign investment, the money laundering that's been investigated initially by David Eby and now mm-hmm. by a different commission.
Right.
This is kind of where this begins to play in, right?
Absolutely.
But it's like, it's not the driving factor. But that's kind of, I think, how that ties in, like this perception that a lot of the problem is based on the other, this community.
The foreigners.
Foreigners.
Right.
And that's, I mean, like, that's a factor, but it's not the whole picture. And I think that's what's really important to establish here, that really it's everyone jumping on the bandwagon. Really, it's all the landowners and land developers jumping on the bandwagon, like in a stock market where you see this speculative frenzy,
mm-hmm.
the stock's going up, everyone's buying in, And then, of course, like most stock markets with penny stocks or speculative stocks, things come crashing down at a certain point. Everyone panics, sells off, and the smart ones wait until it gets low and then buy in again.
Right.
But I think that's kind of what we're seeing here more than anything. So if anyone is going to get upset at anyone, it should be at, you know, let's face it, the developers and the landlords, not all of them, but, you know, the ones that are really just price gouging people, because I think that's an issue. Now, I don't want to demonize any one group. This is a very complex issue.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to take into account that in a capitalist system, the incentive for a landowner, a landlord, and developer is to maximize their profit. And if there's no regulation, and even Adam Smith has mentioned, if anyone reads The Wealth of Nations, even he mentions that sometimes there are market failures and the government needs to intervene and regulate.
Right.
He actually advocates for regulation a fair bit. People just gloss that over all the time. But that, you know, if this is the system we're in and this is the incentive that drives people maximizing profit, then it's no surprise that, you know, we're going to face this massive increase in rents. We've seen it in the 70s.
Right.
We're seeing it again.
Something important to mention here, because I think listeners can get a little carried away with this idea, but that profit seeking by landlords and by developers isn't necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah.
Right. So when we talk about market failures, it seems like that's what's happening in the Vancouver housing market. When you have a monopoly of a few developers and landlords that they can conspire to. I think that's what we were talking about in some of the past cases where a whole building basically jumps their prices up 25%. And that's the real problem and where regulation would be necessary.
Yeah, like real price gouging. And it's not happening everywhere, but it's happening in enough places that it drives the entire market up.
Exactly.
And, you know, it's hard to like blame people in wanting to make a little more money. It's like that's kind of the name of the game.
Mm-hmm.
We all want to make money so we can enjoy our lives. And it's hard to blame a family for taking advantage of the situation when they're just barely making ends meet, even though they own a house. Technically, they're a millionaire, but they're in debt. So what do they have to do to get out of this debt? Well, they have to charge more rent. So this is kind of where, you know, vacancy control should be taken, I think, seriously as a policy option to protect tenants.
Mm-hmm.
But it needs to really be carefully thought out in how to implement it.
Right.
Because you don't want to make things worse.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to make things the same or if not better.
Right.
But I think the evidence that we've pulled up, the history, is really showing that it's actually a fairly positive mechanism. But there are ways, I think, to alter the mechanism so that it can still give landlords and developers room to expand and breathe. Because I don't think we want to shut down our housing market.
No.
Right. Yeah, no. We want to stimulate it, but we also want to protect people. So it's a balancing act.
Yeah, it is. Earlier you were mentioning, I can't remember if you mentioned this on the podcast,
but
we were talking a bit together. In one of those articles, they mentioned migrant flows and how that has.
Yeah, so Lazarin mentions it. She doesn't really get into it in her thesis, but that another contributing factor to kind of market fluctuations is migrant flows. So that would be internally within the country. So people from Alberta, Saskatchewan, Toronto moving into the Vancouver metropolitan area. So as we're getting more people moving into our area, you know, this increases the demand and thus increases supply. Because I think the population roughly in Vancouver itself is growing by about 50,000 to 60,000 people a year.
Right.
But it doesn't mean people are staying because a lot of them are migrant workers, international students, and just kind of people coming here for a bit and then leaving. We see that kind of happen all the time. So it's not necessarily like a bad thing, but it is something to factor in, I think, in terms of the economic and social calculation of how do we deal with this issue. That's important to look at too.
Right.
I think the biggest takeaway from a lot of this is that a lot of more empirical research needs to be done. It's clear that rent control does not have a direct effect on market fluctuations in the way that economists and opponents like to hyperbolize, but that's another key point here. There's a lot of hyperbole on both sides.
And there's a lot of, I think this is what we're mostly getting at. There's a lot of room for more research to be done about this.
Completely.
Much more empirical research. And of course, that's how you gain a better understanding of
What's actually happening.
Anything happening.
So I think if the City of Vancouver wants to consider vacancy control as a policy option, a nice thing to complement it, if it were to be instituted specifically just for Vancouver, the municipality itself, would be some kind of review process or review board that would draw data, right? Do empirical analysis and also look at case-by-case basis where if a landlord wanted to renovate, but they couldn't make enough of a profit off their investment in the renovation, then maybe they should have an exemption, and they should be allowed to, you know, set their rent or set their rental price at a higher rate than what would currently be set. Some kind of accommodation, I think, or room for developers and landlords, you know, they need to be given incentives too, to think, okay, vacancy control is not the worst. It can be good if I still have some incentives to consider making money. But the point is, we want to stop the price gouging.
Right.
Right? We don't want this insane price gouge. It's fair, though, that investors should make some profit, some return. But where that return kind of is, where that threshold is, you know, kind of what we're beginning to really get into. How much is too much? We all want the idea of 100%, 1,000% return on our investments, but maybe thinking a little more strategically, maybe considering other people and other social factors, maybe, you know, we need to be a little more conservative and think, let's still make some profit, but also look out for each other.
Yeah.
So any other thoughts, Josh? This is a complex issue. I'm sure we'll discover more and more as we keep researching.
Certainly a complex issue. Just these past few days doing more research on the issue, it's been fascinating to me. It's something very local.
Yeah.
Affects a lot of people. A lot of people have been talking about it. It's always in the news. One of the biggest issues in, you know, municipal politics and provincial British Columbia politics. So it's,
I think
there's information out there. There needs to be more. But
one important thing to note is also that currently in Vancouver, all these taxes have cooled our real estate market. We've seen roughly a double-digit 10% drop in housing prices across Vancouver. But the biggest thing to note here is that rental prices have stayed the same. So I guess we'll just end there. Thanks for being on the show. And thank you.
Yeah.